This is in the room that I don't know. Is everybody working in quantum information or people outside the field of quantum information? It's important for me because I would definitely like use examples that come from QI, so maybe I should go slower on these, like when the time comes. So who is working in quantum information? Foundation, good. Okay. So, like, don't hesitate to stop me. You can see the numbers on top of the screen later, like it's like 37 slides, but actually animation are like decoupled in many slides, so it should be short and I can skip stuff. I prefer that you get the content. So for me, like I take a very naive point of view when I go to like study group representation, because it's a subject that I've seen like during my physics training, but I never paid like much attention to it, and then bam, it became really important with what I do, which is using semi-definite programming to compute bounds on things in quantum information. So the idea of this talk is basically to take a very basic approach and use numerics. And it's a collaboration with a few people. In terms of references, I have this slide of references. The idea is that I put every introductory article or paper. It's not like the paper you should cite, but it's definitely the paper you should read if you go into the field. I can send the PDF later, so after the talk, come to me and I'll send an email with this slide and the links that you can click. The plan will be like this. Like the first thing, actually I realized something, like this is small, right? So I didn't use a font that's too small, but definitely I can optimize some stuff over here. Can do something like that. And do you see something on the screen? Not, yes, you do. And if I do that, that would be good. And now I need to kind of click on this one. So it's a good thing that I have actually a mouse. Good, wow, that's much better. So for things like what's a group representation, what are we looking for? That will be the first part. The second part is how do we decompose representation into irreducibles and find the change of basis. The main idea is to use commutants, or sometimes also called decentralized algebra. We'll see by example what it is. Then applications. Part of it will be pedagogical, like solve CHSH, and part of it will be like just to brag to see what we are capable of achieving with that. And part four is basically when I'm stuck because I lack the background knowledge. So if you know somebody who knows about the things I'm going to mention in part four, I would be super happy to hear about them. So the idea is that we start with a group, G, and a representation is going to be a map from that group to matrices in a certain field. Here I put like the real field, but it could be complex numbers or rational numbers. And it's going to take an element of the group and send it to a matrix. But actually, it's kind of a step that everybody is doing in representation theory, is assuming that the representation is unitary. And what I will be doing, because I'm going to do numerics, I will assume that this representation is finite dimensional. As an example, let's take the symmetric group. It's basically all permutation of three elements. And that group is generated, so like, this is finite group theory, like cycles, like one goes to two, goes to three, goes back to one, and flip one and two. So the symmetric group is completely generated by cycles and transposition, because you can use a cycle to put the transposition where you want it. And then what you do, you specify the representation of S3. Here's the natural representation. It acts on a vector by permuting coordinates, you say. Okay, I send this cycle to that matrix, and I send this transposition to that matrix. That's going to permute things. I'm skipping over like convention of notation. It's really a pain, like to use the left action or whatever, like skipping over that. Everything in this talk will be consistent. That's the only thing that matters. What I realized that we don't have much. The gamma is very high, so this should be like pink and light blue. I use like color coding. It's not necessary to understand the talk, but I see it's like less nice than what I had on my screen, whatever. So what's going to happen? We have this representation, and we are going to use that change of basis matrix to see if we can put that the matrices of that representation in a block diagonal form. And indeed, that's what happens when we multiply the images of the generators, and images of the generators are all that matter to describe fully the representation. We see that they have this block diagonal structure. Here we always have a one, and here we have like something else. Of course, what we can't guess from just what's on the screen is that there is no other basis that would split this further. So on that, you have to trust me. But when it happens, we know that we have the finest decomposition. And we will call the blocks irreducible representations. Yeah?
In the middle matrix, what's the blank indicating?
It's a zero. Like, it's a convention, like, everything that will be blank. Oh, I use blanks for two things. Like, when it's zero or sparse, I will not put zero because it's confusing. And sometimes, if matrices are symmetric or Hermitian, I just show the upper triangle. So, the problem statement is this. Like, we have a group. We have a representation on a real or complex vector space. And we want to split that vector space into a direct sum of subspaces, such that the matrix of the representation, whatever is the group element, is diagonal in across this this split. And of course, our goal is to find that basis matrix U. This is slightly different than what people usually do with group theory, where they would say, oh, you want to know which irreducible appear, just use the character table or something like that. No, here we really want the change of basis matrix. And sometimes we even want that this basis is like nice numerically. We'll see a bit later what that means.
Is the Schur-Weil transform an example of
output? It's related. It's related. But here I'm not considering directly unitary groups. Like, everything that's in this talk will be about finite group representations. Schur-Weil applies when you have like the symmetric group and unitaries.
And the rotation?
Yes. Yes. I don't understand actually the generalization of Schur-Weil very well. This is where I'm going.
But it feels like the question you're asking is, had you been asking the same question about Lie groups rather than finite groups,
mm-hmm.
Schur-Weil would be an example of the kind of answer you want.
Yes.
Describe
yes.
for me exactly what the unitary that takes me from computation basis to the irreducible representations.
Yes. Okay. Yes. What I'm going to rephrase, like graphically, every element that we have talked about. So we have a group. We have a representation. This representation is in a vector space of a field. We have a decomposition algorithm that's going to split. And this algorithm gives us a change of basis. And basically, where we can work is everywhere here. So the first question, because everything will happen on a computer, how general can we make the description of the group? What I will present is about finite groups. But during my last trip, we found a way to go to compact groups, like unitaries and so on. But often in quantum information, we won't have a single unitary group. Well, many of them, and they combine in some way. How do we represent that on a computer? And how do we provide the user something nice to work with this, like to construct more complex groups from simple ones? Representation, or do we describe the representation on a computer? That's, again, a problem. And we can manipulate those representations as well. So what primitives do we give to people? In terms of the field, it's like, how do we compute with these things? First, there was a question of real versus complex numbers. Then, do we use exact number fields, like rationals or cyclotomics? Or do we use like floating point numbers? And finally, maybe we're interested in keeping like problems with integer coefficients. So sometimes, just working with rational and integers would be interesting. Algorithms, I know several variants that we could use. The big question is like, what's the trade-off between speed, robustness, precision? Can we put formal statement on the precision that we achieve? And the change of basis, if we have some sparsity, we want to preserve it. And I don't know, like the numerical packages, they don't do that very well. Sometimes by doing the numerical analysis, for example, if we can expect to have rational representation, we can just round up the numbers and recover the solutions. And if we can do a proper error analysis, we can just brute force it and use interval arithmetic at the end. That's also an option to certify the results. So nothing that here it will feel very hacky what I say, but in the end you have a way to make it like certified. Okay, that was it. So there is something already right now you can use. This is not a tutorial, so I'm not going to play with the software, but you can go there, download it. It's for MATLAB or Octave, and there is a tutorial, so you can just follow it and do simple computations. But what I have right now, the software is much more limited than what I want to achieve. I only have finite groups. Those groups, the representation are expressed by images of the generators. It only works for real representations. algorithmically, it's a bit limited, so it cannot go for the dimension bigger than, let's say, 3,000 or 5,000. But still, like in terms of sparsity and precision, it's pretty good. So that was like the first part, problem statement. If there are questions, I'm very happy to take them right now. Otherwise, we'd like just move with like what, like how are we going to achieve this?
Can you clarify what you meant by precision, sparsity and precision?
Sparsity, for example, to give an example, when you do like some square relaxations, the representation corresponds to a basis of polynomials. And you already have like the degrees, polynomials of degree 1, 2, 3, 4. So already by these degrees, you already have a natural split of the representation in sub-representations. If your algorithm is dumb, it's going to mix all of these sub-representations together. But if you're clever, you can realize, okay, I already have a natural split according to like the coordinate of the Euclidean space, and you preserve that. So it's kind of preserve the structure that's already there, and it can be done cheaply. It's more like implementation details.
What do you mean by precision then?
Precision is that what I'm going to show here is floating point. So depending on what algorithm you use, you're going to be closer to the like real change of basis or not. So in general, like the precision on like the projector for problem of size, let's say 100 or 200, is around 10 to the minus 15 in coordinates. So it's not bad at all. But I have no formal statement, like what can we expect, and so on. And I didn't do much numerical analysis, so that's a direction to explore. Other questions?
Can I just make sure I understand? So you're starting with an exact representation?
Yes. Yeah. Often, like, we could start with something that's already floating point, but most of the time, the starting representation is permutation or sine permutation, something like that. But anyway, like, the first step will be to express what you give exactly in floating point numbers, so it's actually already approximate at step one. Okay, so the I didn't ask if there are further questions. It's kind of good. So the idea is to use the commutants. And for that, I'm going to go back to the example of S3 that we had before, and we had the natural representation of S3 that split. So that in the symmetry adapted basis, the representation is block diagonal. And images of the blocks are here. I just repeated them. What we are going to do is to look in that adapted basis. So this is why I put this U. I'm looking for matrix that commutes with all images of all elements of the group. So I want this for all G. So now what I'm going to do is to take that UXU and split it into blocks with the same size as what I had here. And look at what I have inside. And actually, spoiler alert, like that's what's coming on the next slide. But my matrix X in that basis will have this form. A scalar here and basically a multiple of the identity over there. And why is that? It's because that matrix, I can like look at the subblocks and see, okay, actually that block is a map from V1 to V1. And that block is a map from V2 to V1. And this block here is a map from V2 to V2. And V1 and V2 are these two the subspaces corresponding to the sub-representations. What I'm going to use is Shor's lemma. And it tells me if I have an application from one space to another space, such that this map is invariant on the application of the group, so source and image and source here. So what happens if the representation are not equivalent, or if they are not isomorphic? This has to be zero. So like that first statement here already tells me that, okay, knowing that those two representations don't have the same dimension, they cannot be isomorphic, so these two blocks have to be zero. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing is that if the two representations are equivalent, and here it's actually a bit stronger, I ask that they have exactly the same basis, so that the matrices are the same, then F has to be a scalar multiple of the identity if the underlying field is algebraically closed. Or for reals, it's a bit more messy. But sometimes it's important to use reals. And if the representation are equivalent but up to a change of basis, then basically F is going to be that change of basis. So it's really cool because now we can use that to cheat our way around the problem. what's going to happen is that we, so it's going to come a bit later, but let's assume we can take an arbitrary matrix X that commutes with the representation. So what we know is that in some unknown basis, that X has this form. And it's really cool because now we could actually recover the basis from the eigenvalue decomposition of that matrix here. But only in one case, if alpha is not equal to beta. And in that case, there is a single degeneracy that this eigenvalue has multiplicity 2. Then it means that basically whatever basis here will work. But that degeneracy is not a problem. Like a basis of a subspace is, of course, degenerates up to unitaries. We are only going to have a problem if alpha is equal to beta, because then basically any unitary u will do. So we have to choose our x carefully. And this is what we are going to do. So like to show like how we are going to pick this x, I'm using an example. So let's take again like the representation of the symmetric group S3. But now I've written it, of course, in the original basis because I don't know the change of basis matrix. So what's funny is that because S will act by permuting rows and columns, I can send any off-diagonal element to any other, and I can send any diagonal element to any other. So any X that commutes has to have that form. Now what I can do is just compute the eigenvalue in decomposition of that, which I did, and I get that here. So now I see that this algorithm is going to work, like do the eigenvalue decomposition of some random matrix from this coefficient, if and only if these two eigenvalues are not the same. And to do that, so basically that's what's written here, what I'm going to do is to sample A and B from some, let's say, continuous measure, like a measure that don't have that doesn't have atoms. And in that case, the pathological set will have measure zero, and basically, like almost always get that change of basis matrix. So the process will be like this. We don't take like to start with any matrix, but what's very nice to use, it's a random matrix that sampled from the Gaussian ensemble. Means that basically all elements are taken from the normal distribution. What's really cool in that case that eigenvalues there are some guarantees about the separation. So we won't have that pathological case appearing. Then what we do, we take that matrix that's not commuting with the group, and we just symmetrize it. And after trailing, it's clear that this X will commute. Then we do the eigenvalue decomposition, and we will get eigenvalues and their multiplicities. And if you remember what happened to the blocks of the representation, it was a scalar multiple of something. So the multiplicity of the representation is actually, the multiplicity of the eigenvalue is basically the dimension of the representation I'm looking for, and so on. And then, I have my U, there is some post-processing I can do. Representation can have copies, we will see that later. We need to process it a little bit. And the real case is a bit painful because of the types of representation that can appear. I'll talk about it later as well. So basically, we reduce the problem of decomposing a representation to how can I project an arbitrary matrix into the commutant or centralizer algebra space? Sorry, but you had a question.
Before you continue, can you go back and one more?
Yeah.
I'm just curious, in this example, you could have a flag that told you that you hit degeneracy when you're sampling, so you could just sample again. In general, do you know if you sampled badly?
That's a question. I'd like to have a probabilistic statement there. Like, with probability, let's say 2 to the minus blah, I'm not degenerate, and this is a real split. Like here, it's kind of to see that I'm degenerate, I have to know the change of basis.
Yeah.
So if I don't know it, how do I know that I'm correct? The idea is that if you sample from the Gaussian orthogonal ensembles, so I'm taking that matrix as an example. So in the symmetry-adapted basis, you're going to have, before symmetrization, you're going to have all the eigenvalues. Projecting into the commutant is going to replace eigenvalues in each block by their average. So like, if eigenvalues were separated like this, let's say well separated, after projection, they will just group together. So average separation will increase. So by using like quantum matrix theory, probably what I can say is that with probability blah, eigenvalue will be separated at least by blah. And then I know that my numerical algorithm works well if I have that separation on the eigenvalues. But I'm not much of a numerical analyst, so it's like work to be done. Of course, once you split, you can always check that it's correct by looking into like okay, checks actually it's actually a bit difficult. But anyway, like after you got the decomposition and so on, you go back to the SDP, you do the transformation, and there you can check that if the like what's the error that you have. So this can be controlled later in the process. Let's go back to this. So we reduce the problem of splitting a representation to how do we project. And here we'll distinguish two cases. First one is about discrete groups. Second one is about continuous groups. Mostly going to talk about this one. I'm working on the second one with ideas comes from the David Gross group. But we can discuss that like later during the around a cup of coffee if you're interested in the second question. For discrete groups, the idea is that doing the sum is extremely expensive because it involves summing over all elements of the group. And if you take the symmetric group over n elements, it's going to be n factorial, which is not something that scales nicely. So the idea is to look at the decomposition of the group into sets T, such that every element of the group has a unique product form by taking elements out of those sets. And you get that by taking a chain of subgroups. It's something that can be achieved. And then what you do, G is going to act, it's a left action. So you first symmetrize by elements in the set Tm, then you symmetrize by elements in the set T minus M minus 1, and so on until you get to T2 and T1. And now instead of doing order of G operation, what you do is just like multiplication, you do just size of T1 plus size of T2 plus size of T3 and so on. So for the symmetry group, it goes from n factorial to n square.
No.
Any chain of subgroup will work. It doesn't need to be normal, which is actually good, because it will work for simple groups as well. And actually, I haven't found much in the literature like how to find like some kind of like maximal, like longest chain of subgroups. Normal subgroups, yes, but like just subgroups, no idea.
How is it that you're finding this decomposition?
So how do I do it? For the symmetry group, what you do is, let's say you have five elements. You look like, what can I do with the last two? Now I need to position the third one, so I have a cycle on the last three, then a cycle on the last four, and a cycle on the last five. So it's kind of 5 + 4 + 3 + 2. But now if you're clever, you realize that, oh, I do a cycle around four, so I can do like one step, like just do the jump +2, and then like another element in the decomposition will do like this +1. So there are ways to split things.
So for the symmetric group, it's pretty easy to...
I think I went to like the end, but I don't have a proof of that. And of course, now if you have a direct product of symmetric groups, you just like concatenate the chains. So it's constructively, it's not so bad. If you have an arbitrary group, you need to cheat a little bit. But it's kind of technical and not really the topic. But you know, this projection can be done fast. That's the message. Any question up till now? So in principle, we solve the problem. Like we take a group, we know to do this projection, we do the eigenvalue decomposition, and we get it. So the question, like, what is it useful for?
In the previous slide, you said that every element of the group can be expressed in this product form. But the property you're relying on is that as I vary over the elements of all M subgroups, I vary over the full group with no duplicates.
But yes.
It's not the case that there's... that different products give me the same group.
Yes, yes, it's
that's
unique.
Why this thing is the same as the average of the whole group.
Exactly, okay. And basically, like Tm will correspond to the finest subgroup you have in the chain, and then you go to the like last before smallest, and you look at the transversal. They give you 10 m minus 1, and so on, and you go back like this. Applications now. So basically, I told you the story backwards. Question. No, anybody can know something about like the topic because.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what's the property that this rho T1, rho T2 hold?
Oh, it works because rho is an is a group homomorphism. So if I have rho of G times H, it's rho G times rho H, which means that when I have like rho Tm, like 1, 2, 3, 4 here, and I do the product before by distribution, then I basically will do the enumeration. That's it. There is nothing really fancy here. But there could be a link with some other area, but I don't know much about like the topic you mentioned. So.
The equation that it looks like, but which has a very different interpretation, is that if you did a sequence of measurements, then you would have the rows being projectors. And if you forgot about the outcome, you'd sum over the index of the projectors. Mm-hmm. But here the rows are not projectors, they're unitary representations of the group. So I don't think there's any connection between this formula.
Thanks, Rob. Thomas, you're like, okay, good. So no applications.
Are you going to talk about
So everything will still work if you find a way to do this integration. And what I do know is Monte Carlo integration. Okay. But then it scales quite badly, so there are ways to make it a bit more efficient. But then I don't want to say it publicly because it's very fragile now. Like we need to know exactly what we want to do. So if like I know Thomas, for example, like has experience in like Monte Carlo integration. Like there was this trick of using something called quantum expanders. It works well, but I don't have like much results there. So that's going to be for another time. If you're interested, like we can go and take a coffee afterwards. And I'll tell you all about it. Other questions? So let's see. We already spent like half an hour, and it's like half the talk. I still want to fit this into 45 minutes because that leaves time for questions afterwards. But I may go like 5 minutes overboard. I'll probably skip some examples, but we could go back later if you're interested into that. Like the important part is like why did I came to that? That's because of some indefinite programming, and the idea is that a lot of programming in quantum information can be mapped to some indefinite problems. Which is basically saying that some matrix or some linear combination of matrices is some indefinite positive, which means that basically like the vector matrix vector product is non-negative. But now, like if that matrix had a block diagonal form, that constraint reduces to basically saying that each of those blocks is SDP, which is much cheaper computationally. So now the idea is to see if my problem is symmetry, then probably the matrix chi will commute with some group representation, and then I can do all the things that I've done before to find what is the change of basis and write it into blocks, and then it's going to be cheaper. Application. Before we go to application, we have to be extremely careful of one thing. And I spent like a week not understanding the difference between dimension and representation dimension and multiplicity. So I put like this example so that you will not be as confused as I was. So let's take a matrix that's chi that has absolutely no symmetry. So we can still fit it into this framework by saying actually it has a symmetry corresponding to the trivial group, like just identity, and the representation in that case basically just the identity matrix. Does that mean that we have like just one kind of representation, like the trivial one, and just one block? Like size 1 by 1, no. What happens that trivial representation will split indeed into like a lot of very small diagonal blocks, which is just like scalar 1 inside. And chi will like split as well. Like so I put like this identity with dimension 1, like what we've seen before. And I put like the scalar in front. But now what happens that all these subspaces are isomorphic. So I can't kill the off-diagonal elements. So basically, that matrix is still dense. I can't do anything. So that's basically like a repeated Schur's lemma. Like if they are not isomorphic, it's zero. But if they are equivalent, then something will be there. And here, like chi has absolutely no degeneracy. So it's going to be very important to find like what are the multiplicities of representation, which copies appear in the splits. So as a summary, we will like split the matrix into like families of irreducible representation. And inside one, what's going to happen is that we will have one copy of the representation, second copy, and so on, M1 copies. Each of the representation in for chi will give us the identity matrix. And that big thing here is basically a Kronecker product, but with the identity on the right. So it doesn't look very much block diagonal, but like the SDP property is preserved if we just permute the elements of the cron, which is what I do here. And then basically what appears in my SDP matrix is D1 copies of the blocks. So we have to be a bit careful. Like, dimension of the representation is what's good because it gives us sparsity. The multiplicity of the representation is what's bad. It's what gives us the size of the block. So this is what I repeated here, like dimension D1, multiplicity M1. We start from a block of size D1, M1. Then by doing this trick, we get D1 copies of blocks that are M1 by M1. But because they're identical, we just remove and keep a single copy. And we go to a block of dimension M1 times N1. Example now, because this was a lot of abstract things. Probably everybody knows about the CHCH inequality. And one way to compute the upper bound on that we can achieve with quantum mechanics is to use sum of square relaxation. I'm not going to repeat that. And I can't explain it very well if I don't write the math, so I take it for granted. Basically, what we do is we put the expectation values of product of the operators, and the operators are basically x, ax, and by, and they have like eigenvalues +1 and -1, and they are projectors. So we want to maximize I such that this matrix is SDP and I is this. So it has 10 degrees of freedom, that matrix. But what happens is that the objective function that we have is symmetric. The first thing is that if I permute A and B, I stays invariant. The second thing, if I flip by sending A to minus A and B to minus B, whatever X and Y is, this stays invariant. So this is basically what I put here. You send A0 to B1 to like either you flip the two or you take a minus sign everywhere. And the last thing you can do, it's like the last symmetry of CHSH. You can permute just the inputs of Bob if you put a minus sign for the second measurement of Alice. It goes that if you have X times Y, if you send Y to Y +1, then you get an extra X that you need to correct. So that's symmetry. What we are going to do now is to take the group that generated by these three things. It's a dual group of order 16. And we are going to symmetrize that matrix by just summing and averaging. And after we sum and average, because what happens is that if I have a solution, then any image of that matrix under the group will be a solution as well with the same objective value. So then I can just do the average over them because it's convex. And then finally, I will have something that's invariant under the group. That's the trick. So let's go. So we start, and I'm sorry, like you don't get the nice colors, but the first thing that we do is we say that we can permute the parties. So A0 is going to be equal to B0, A1 to B1, and A1 B0 is equal to A0 B1. Let's do that. Paf. Just replaced by one of them. The second thing is that we can do this correlated output flip. And here we have like twice a minus sign, so all these terms are preserved, but it will kill the first line, basically. Done. And then the last one is like this weird symmetry. It will send this one to minus this one, so 0. And then it will equal elements in there. What I get at the end is a matrix that looks like this. So I went from 10 degrees of freedom to a single degree of freedom. And now that matrix commutes under the representation of the group in a special basis, and I put like all the details of the representation there. Just trust me, you can go back to the slide later. And then if I do the change of basis, the matrix that I get is this. So now this represents like copies. I can just remove them. And because the matrix is totally diagonal, it's not even an SDP, it's no linear program. So I went from a problem that had 10 degrees of freedom, matrix size 5, to a problem that's basically three inequality constraints and a single degree of freedom. And now you can read basically CHSH, the objective value directly from there. Like this max will be 1 over square root of 2 times 4, 2 square root of 2. You get it. Question for that first example, because that basically like the whole method in a nutshell here. I can skip the rest of the slides. Like, this is like the important part. So when there are like no questions, is it like a very good sign or a very bad sign? Oh, okay. So that's a really good question. How do I know that what are the symmetries of that expression of up here? So I do two things. It's not really in the topic of the talk, but I'll mention it briefly. The first one is that I will work. I need to use operation for the group that preserve the physics. So for example, I can't send A0 to 2A0 because it's going to change the eigenvalues of my measurements and not going to respect the problem statement. But basically here, like permutation of Alice and Bob, it's fine because it's something I could do in the lab. Relabeling outcomes, something I can do in the lab, it's fine. Permuting measurement settings, fine, something I can do in the lab. So I basically have a few permutation of operators that I can do and these minus signs, but in a way that respects the physics. And then I need to like to see what preserve exactly the form that I have up there. Actually, the group of all operations that is physical is of the order of 100 something. Then I look like all of these elements, which one preserve that that polynomial. I can tell you, like it's computational group theory. There are good algorithms for that, which is how I found this third relabeling. Because usually, like if I just stare at CHSH, I'm not going to find it. There are softwares tools to do that. Other questions?
Do you happen to have the eigenvalues of this thing when you do a Gaussian sampling? What does it look like?
You mean the commutant that I use when I decompose the representation? You mean? I never like looked in practice. Kind of look at the end of the talk. I'm not like start opening MATLAB and so on.
You went through the simplification matrix. You sort of applied each of the generators once, I think. So you sort of talked about.
Oh.
So it wasn't. Oh. You didn't decompose the group, but you just changed subgroup and do it that way.
Okay. Okay. There are
is that just pedagogical?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is that what I will feed into RepLab is not the sum of square relaxation. Like before I go to RepLab, I need to take in account those symmetries when I construct the problem. And in the end, my SDP is this one. So like RepLab, I have another software and all it does, it's like, that's not what I presented before. Like, end problem is this. So I have a SDP and the SDP matrix is symmetric. And now I'm going to split it into blocks. The part before, it's a different algorithm. And actually, what we could say is, okay, take that matrix and sample and take the eigenvalues of that. It will not work because SOS matrices, they have an additional structure that destroy the genericity property of that we have seen before. So when I find the change of basis, I basically look how the group acts on these rows and columns, what's the representation, and then I use the algorithm with the commutants. But it has nothing to do with that matrix. I will use a different one. So actually, the Ellie's question is not only about eigenvalues, but like which matrix do you use? Not the one coming from the mons, but one coming from the group. But this is becoming a bit technical. Like,
okay, I understand. This is the step where you used all the machinery you described earlier.
Yeah.
And everything before is just setting up.
Yes.
It's an interesting problem.
Yeah. For example, let's say you have a state and you want to apply the PPT criterion, and you know the state has some symmetries. So you will write that matrix with the partial transpose. And then, assuming that state is symmetric under some representation, then you can look at what the representation becomes under the partial transpose. You know, instead of solving that big matrix, you're going to take something that has smaller blocks. That would be like another example. But I'm working on continuous groups, so I don't have like examples that are outside of summer score relaxations for now, but this is really where I want to go, like apply that to like continuous problems as well. Just to say what we can do with this, it's still 5 minutes remaining. I'll come back to this, maybe to this continuous thing later. I treat the two. It's still a question like, what can we do with what dimensions and how does it converge? So it's interesting. It's not like the biggest problem in quantum information, but it's nice to have like more precise upper bounds on I3222. And using those techniques, like split the matrices into blocks, and of course like SDP preprocessing, I could compute up to level 5, and basically like using like high precision solvers, no, have an upper bound that's actually smaller than everything that we have known before. And the idea is that what's not in the talk gives us the reduction in identifying like which variable inside the matrix are equal. So that would be for a different day, but we go from 20,000 to around 3,000. And then we still have a big matrix, 600 by 600. Using the techniques in this present talk, we know that matrix of 600 by 600 has some symmetries, so then we can split it further. And that enabled the use of high-precision algorithm that would be otherwise too slow to use on that problem. Last problem that I will mention, it's a bit of a shame that I don't have more time because I would have included, and here basically everything is based on RepLab. Because it's a different kind of relaxation. Yeah?
Are you really going from like a tractal to intractal, or is it just a performance speed up? Because 600 by 600.
Yeah.
You can play with it, like it's not insane. But when you break it up into groups,
yeah,
into these blocks,
yeah,
usually like it's not entirely magic because there's dispersity.
Yeah.
So when you work in these blocks, like versus just doing the first step, what kind of advantage you see?
You get an additional like a one or two order of magnitude. Here, like in this previous example, I'm not using like Mosaic or one of these off-the-shelf solvers. I'm using one that works in quadruple precision arithmetic. So 600 by 600 would be like a month of computation or whatever. Like it's very slow. So because the constant factor increases, so I'm very happy that I could split that. But maybe the next example is going to be more impressive. So before I showed you like oh you take a sum of squares SDP and you identify things, there is another hierarchy that works for finite dimensional problems that's purely based on sampling. And here you basically use RepLab from start to finish, not going into details. But what's really, really cool is that if we take a problem when the symmetry groups grows as the problem complexity grows, often the semi-definite relaxation at the end will have the same complexity regardless of the dimension. And here is an example of a random access code. Random access code means that you, Alice receives a certain number of, a sequence of numbers, basically n numbers between 1 and d. And she's going to encode all these numbers into a single quantum system. So you could have like n inputs, like, but of each of the inputs is dimension d, but you have just one quantum system of dimension d. So there is some kind of compression step that you have. You go from n classical inputs to one quantum encoding. And Bob receives like which one he needs to retrieve, and he tries to guess what's that. And then basically you win the game if Bob guessed correctly. So that's the random access code. What's really cool there is that it's a problem that's as symmetrical as it can be. You can permute the different inputs. You can permute the values inside of each input. And what it means is that n is the number of values and d is the dimension. As you increase the dimension for fixed n, then basically the interesting part is this. The size of the blocks that you get in your SDP, they are basically constant after like you escape like 2 or 3. Which means that in principle, you can compute that for any d. I mean, for the SDP solver, it's not going to be more difficult. And why is that? Because the symmetry increases as the problem size increases, which is really, really nice. So that's the second example that I wanted to show. That's going to be the end of the example section. So you have n dits that you encode in one qudit, and then you compute like how well you can encode and decode that.
So is this happening?
Where?
You said encoding in qudits, then encodes in dits.
Oh yes, indeed. Thanks. Nice catch. Road ahead. I don't have time for that. Like, if you know somebody, like, who knows about Lie groups, and because I know TC knows about that, and I'm very happy for that. Or maybe just to show that we can probably do something super cool with process diagrams to include symmetries in them. Like, what are the symmetries of CHSH? We kind of represent groups directly on the diagrams. I'd love like to work a bit more like how to handle better real and versus complex representations. And the numerical analysis part is the part where I have the most difficulty of working because it's not my background. I don't think we have many people at PI who do numerical analysis, then of proving backward the forward error propagation, things like that. So I should probably look at UW, like who is doing what. As a conclusion, like the only conclusion I would have, like go to the website, download the software, and like take like small groups that you've seen in like lectures or maybe that you're even using, and play with them and see what the composition works. Because like the talk was quite abstract, but when you play with things, it's kind of jumps in your face, and that's really cool. I just wish I had that when I was like learning about group theory, because playing with things is always more interesting. That said, I thank you for your attention, and then we can like, go to questions.
Could you comment a bit more about checking to see whether your change of existing groups is correct? And I ask this motivated by trying to take the numerical change of basis,
mm-hmm.
And perhaps not for SDP purposes,
yeah.
But just to learn an analytic change of basis for
uh-huh.
these results, so you could obviously take your important attempt to rationalize, or you could sample initially from a rational space, but then you have these issues. But if you know what the blocks are supposed to be, then is it like easy to sort of guess and check that you have the correct answer?
So to check, like formally, what you should do is to use the character formulas, like inner product of characters, and then if it's one, then you know the representation is irreducible. The problem of that is like you go back to scale one, like you need to sum over all the group's elements, and it's really expensive. Now there are like numerical ways to do that. One idea is to sample a Gaussian matrix, project it into like the change of basing that you think you have, and check that the off-diagonal blocks that should be zero are actually zero. That would be a way, and that inside the irreducible blocks, all the eigenvalues are the same. But it's going to be numerical, so if things are really close up to machine precision, like when it is incorrect, when it is like just a numerical error, so that's where the numerical analysis part would come in play. Like it would tell you like, oh, if you have this, then with probability blah, then it's correct. And then you could repeat the process as many times as you wish to get more and more certainty until you basically get into the probability of getting a gamma ray destroying your computation. And as kind of a numerical experimentalist, I accept that. Probably it wouldn't fly in pure math.
You speak as though like summing over the elements of the group is computationally more expensive than finding an eigenvector decomposition.
Yeah. For example, because it's basically, actually you don't even need to do the eigenvalue decomposition. That's like the first step. There are ways to actually just get what you need. So in practice, it's very fast. But if you wanted to do that by using like character formulas, you would need the character table of the group. So it's not that expensive to compute the character table of a group. This can be extremely complex in the number of different moving pieces you're going to have in your software. You're going to gap for the character table and then go back to MATLAB for, and I didn't want that. Like for me, that's as good as it could be.
Yes, I had a question. So the kind of input to your program, for instance, the finite group is just a number of like finite number of matrices which represent, for instance, the generators of the group.
Yes.
So I think maybe we talked about this, but then you could also use your program to look at what happens when you restrict to subgroups, right? So you just input.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the continuous case, could you also, for instance, just you have a representation of SU4?
Yeah.
You could just restrict to like SU2 tensor SU2,
yeah.
and you get that decomposition as well. Using
Like the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, something like that. In that case, there was like a specialized paper, it's called Smiley. They kind of do that. They use like the same technique of projecting on the commutant. It's not really clear how they achieve that. What precision do they have? But in like if you have a group problem of where like that kind of split would be important, then of course we should look at it.
Yeah, in general, it's quite like doing decomposition, like restriction of SUDADB to the tensor.
Yeah.
That's quite a hard problem in general. Like,
okay. So for example, like things that I've been playing with, and it's not like a formal result yet. For example, if you take U tensor U tensor U tensor U, that's exactly Schur-Weil duality, and the representation you get inside would correspond to the Young tableaus. I don't know much about this, but I know it exists. The problem is as soon as you no longer have U, 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 but U, 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 U conjugate, or maybe just one conjugate, there is like a whole one paper on that. But now you have like two conjugates, you're out of luck. But here, like that would work like in any case. So for example, I played with U tensor U, and I get the singlet and the triplet on higher dimensions, like the Werner state and the rest. And if I put like U and U conjugate, then I get the isotropic states. So like it works. For example, one question that I had on like to-do list is for unitary groups and like tensor products and conjugates, is that clear that the change of basis is always going to be rational, can always be made rational? It seems so, like the projector can be rational. What's the smallest field we need to use to compute with these things? No idea, but it seems it's always rational numbers, which is cool because you can do that and then round up onto like 10 to minus 12, recover fractions, and then you have everything you need. So it's pretty cool, but I have no guarantees that it will always work. Other question? Yeah.
Can you talk more about the sort of early parts of the pipeline where you take, say, an STP problem instance and learn what the symmetries are and then write down a representation of the generators? Or is that come from expertise
on
the problem?
Okay. I have actually slides exactly on that, so I suggest, but maybe not the 20 people in this room are interested. What I suggest, we finish the Q&A, and then like those who are interested, I just go quickly to those slides. It's going to take like 5 to 10 minutes. Other questions?
I can conceive of an application of described in quantum reference frames.
Uh-huh.
So the kind of problem that we have a pretty good handle on is if I'm trying to send to you information about some symmetry group, like rotations, for example, and So I may have, say, a bunch of spin systems that I'm going to send to you. So you want to know what's the optimal state for me to send and what's the optimal POVM for you to do in order for me to be able to communicate an element of the rotation group to you as much information as possible. So we have a pretty good handle, even for generic, compact Lie groups, what the optimal states and POVMs look like. And typically, those optimal states and POVMs are described in terms of the irreducible representations of the group on the system you're using.
Okay.
But then the question of, now how would I prepare that optimal state? That requires me to know the unitary description in terms of the irreducible representation.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know the unitary that I would do to get that.
Okay.
And so in the case of rotations, that's what the Schur-Weil transform gives you.
Yeah.
But here's another example where I'm not sure we know how to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
So suppose I want to communicate to you an element of the permutation group for n elements.
Uh-huh.
So if I had a system of dimension n factorial, on order of n factorial, I could just encode classically which permutation element, and then you could decode it and everything would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have a smaller dimension, I can still encode information about the permutation group, and your probability of guessing which element I'm encoding is non-trivial, and you can show that there's sort of an advantage relative to if I tried to encode it in a classical system with the same number of distinguishable states. Results of that flavor.
Okay.
So I haven't thought about this problem in a while, but I suspect we might already know what the optimal states and measurements are in the language of the irreducible representation of the symmetric group. But then how would I physically prepare those optimal states? Like if I was trying to communicate an element of SDP, which is order six, but I only have a three-dimensional system to do it, there would be some question of, you know, how do I encode these six elements of the permutation group into this three-dimensional system and figure out exactly what the unitary to apply is. Anyways, and for every group you could think of, there's an analogous problem. So you could do this, like the example I just gave, for finite groups. You could also do it for complex groups where we don't have the analog of Schurweil transforms.
That's really cool because, like, one thing I'm wondering, like, I know about the unitary group, I don't know much beyond that. For compact groups, there is a problem of the component connected to the identity and like disconnected, like when you have like a certain number of components. I think I understand a little bit like all the group decomposers, but not much beyond that. And now I need to encode that into the software so I can work with it. So if you have like examples with other Lie groups than the unitary, that's fantastic.
Right.
We can like play with it. Just to mention,
can you even do it for finite groups like this permutation group example.
Yes, absolutely. Like so finite group, it's already there, so like that's a given. Just to mention something, this will give you like the change of basis, but it's going to be numerical. There is another approach. It's a software called AREP. It's in the list of things, AREP, and what it gives you is a very structured change of basis matrix. That may be more interesting for like experiments. Because if I know that, I don't know, I have a six-dimensional system and I do the Fourier transform on the first tree and the last tree, and then I permute in this way and then do that. Like as a change of basis, it's much more interesting that here is a big batch of numbers. The only problem with AREP, why I'm not using that, is because it only works for solvable groups. So as soon as you have like S5, you're finished. But that's a nice approach. Like, this is like very crude and numerical, but there are people working to like give me like a computationally efficient way of changing those bases. And if we do an experiment, that would be like, I have this set of optical elements, how do I do that change of bases? Just mentioning like that branch. Other questions? I mean, we'll be here probably like a little bit more. John, you book the room until? Good. So we like for those who want to stay, we can go to this SDP part. Like I will switch my slides. Otherwise, like thank you for your attention. I just love that there were so many questions. So thank you.